From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, murder, mayhem, and mystery. We hear from two masters of the detective novel. Mickey Spillane created the hard-boiled private eye Mike Hammer, and even played Hammer in a movie. P.D. James will talk about the British style of detective writing and why she, a grandmother who likes order and formality, writes so explicitly about violent death. We continue our series on cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Clinton expressed regret at Elizabeth Dole's withdrawal from the presidential race today. Mr. Clinton calls her a very impressive person who is clearly qualified to be president. He said her departure is a loss for the Republican Party and the nation. The president said it's especially troubling that money problems forced her out. He said it underscores how wrong the Senate was to bury campaign finance reform yesterday. The president's planning to travel to Oslo, Norway, for talks with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president's national security adviser, Sandy Berger, announced the trip today, suggesting that this might be the last chance for peace in the Middle East.
There is no greater priority for this administration, and there is no greater priority for this president than to bring about that just, lasting, and comprehensive peace.
President Clinton will be taking advantage of the fact that the two leaders will be in Norway for a ceremony commemorating the Oslo Peace Accords that pushed the Middle East peace process forward almost 7 years ago. President Clinton has said he will do whatever it takes to get the two parties to develop a framework for final status talks. Those talks would tackle the toughest issues remaining between the Israelis and the Palestinians, including statehood for the Palestinians and the status of Jerusalem. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
A new report says that gains in providing health insurance to children through one program are being offset by losses from another. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
The study by the consumer group Families USA looked at the 12 states with the largest numbers of uninsured children, accounting for about two-thirds of uninsured children nationwide. It found that while enrollment in the new Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, grew substantially, the number of children enrolled in the Medicaid program for the poor dropped even more. As a result, fewer children in those states were covered by CHIP and Medicaid in 1999 than were covered by Medicaid alone in 1996. The report blamed the decline on the 1996 welfare reform law, which for the first time cut the automatic link between cash welfare payments and Medicaid coverage. As a result, many children who remain eligible for Medicaid have been accidentally dropped from the rolls or not enrolled at all. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Security has been stepped up at Columbine High School after authorities arrested a student at the Colorado school for allegedly threatening to finish the job, a reference to the gunman who went on a shooting rampage last spring. Jefferson County School District officials said in a statement they will continue to enforce a zero-tolerance policy against violent threats. Stock prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials up 187 points to close at 10,392. The Nasdaq was up 100 points to close at 2788. This is NPR News. Hurricane Jose has ripped through the island of Antigua and is nearing other islands. The storm is 90 miles southeast of St. Martin with winds of 100 miles an hour. Ed Thompson reports from Barbados.
Accounts from Antigua tell of the experience of being in the eye of the storm. The heavy weather started in the morning, flattening houses, uprooting trees, and driving dangerous waves ashore. And high noon, all was calm. 1 hour later, the island was again embroiled in Jose's fury as it snapped power lines and tore roofs from homes. In the coming hours, Jose will move over Anguilla and St. Martin. Then by Thursday, the center of Hurricane Jose is expected to be over the U.S. and British Virgin Islands. Puerto Rico, which has already been hit by gusty winds and rain squalls, is likely to get even more of the same. But the coast of the U.S. appears to be out of harm's way. Jose is expected to curve north in the Atlantic, north of the Dominican Republic, and head out to sea. For NPR News, I'm Ed Thompson in Barbados.
A divided federal appeals court has thrown out a $315,000 judgment against ABC over a primetime live report. The story alleged there were unsanitary conditions at the Food Lion grocery store. The Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 2-1 that a North Carolina judge erred in upholding the jury verdict. The jury found the television network committed fraud in its reporting of the story. The show was broadcast in November of 1992. A lead tobacco attorney says he believes damages could exceed $300 billion in a Florida tobacco case, and that, he says, would destroy any industry. The lawyer argued that point in vain today before a Florida appeals court panel. The three judges ruled that a Miami jury may award punitive damages in a single lump sum. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. From Delta Books, publisher of Ithaca, a daughter's memoir of being found by Sarah Safian, the story of an adopted woman who is located by her birth parents. And from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Boys Don't Cry, based on a true story, with Hilary Swank and Chloe Sevigny, in theaters starting Friday.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We continue our series on cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds with hard-boiled writer Mickey Spillane, creator of tough guy detective Mike Hammer. Spillane is one of the best-selling writers of his generation. He wrote his first Mike Hammer novel, I, the Jury, in 1947. His other Hammer stories include Vengeance is Mine, The Big Kill, Kiss Me Deadly, and Black Alley, published in 1996. Mike Hammer has also been spun off into movies and TV series. Spillane actually played the part of Mike Hammer in the 1963 movie The Girl Hunters. In the 30s, Spillane wrote for Slick and Pulp magazines. He also wrote for comic books early in his career and was one of the originators of superheroes Captain Marvel and Captain America. I spoke with Hammer in 1989, when at the age of 71 he had just revived Private Eye Mike Hammer in a novel called The Killing Man. Our interview started with a reading from the first Mike Hammer novel, I, the Jury.
When I looked up, Pat was staring at me strangely. He shook his head. I knew what he was thinking. Mike, lay off. For God's sake, don't go half-cocked about this. I know you too well. You'll start shooting up anyone connected with this and getting a jam you'll never get out of. I'm over it now, Pat. Don't get excited. From now on, I'm after one thing, the killer. You're a cop, Pat. You're tied down by rules and regulations. There's someone over you. I'm alone. I can slap someone in the puss and they can't do a damn thing. No one can kick me out of my job. Maybe there's no way to put up a huge fuss if I get gunned down. But then I still have a private cop's license with the privilege of pack a rod and they're afraid of me. I hate hard, Pat. When I latch onto the one behind this, they're going to wish they hadn't started it. Someday, before long, I'm going to have my rod and my mitt and the killer in front of me. I'm going to watch that killer's face. I'm going to plunk one right in his gut when he's dying on the floor. I may kick his teeth out. You couldn't do that. You have to follow a book because you're a captain of homicide. Maybe the killer will wind up in a chair. You'd be satisfied, but I wouldn't. It's too easy. That killer is going down like Jack did.
Well, I think this sets up the character pretty well. And that whole sense of, and when he's dying on the floor, I may kick his teeth out.
Yeah. How about that?
So, I mean, what does that say about the character? I mean, what did you want to get in there?
Well, the character, something terrible has been done to Mike. His best friend has been shot. Not only shot, but has been shot in a horrible way because the killer wanted to see that guy hurt. Because shot him where it wasn't a death-dealing blow with that shot. He shot him in the gut. He's going to live a while. He's going to be in terrible pain. And that's the way that killer's going to die. So this is the premise of the whole story, that killer's going down just like Jack did, his friend did. And that's what happens.
And Mike Hammer says that in the end, the people have their justice. They get it through guys like me once in a while. You've made Hammer into the guy who's going to get justice outside of the law.
That's right. In this case, he's acting as a, you know, an arm of the law, but in a different way. He can do things that nobody else can do. He's got more reason for doing it. He's not hung up by rules and regulations the way the cop was. And it's a case of personal vendetta on his part. See, I never had Mike Hammer ever taking a case for money. Everything he ever got into was because of a personal motivation. Something happened to somebody he liked, somebody he loved, some situations were terrible, and he got into it, and with no money behind it. He was on his own all the way because this was a personal nature with him. He needed all of his attention.
Hammer seems to take a lot of, almost pleasure in vengeance and in returning pain that's been received. Is it cathartic for you to write that way?
No, I never used that particular idea. When you're going into a tough situation, pain's going to be there. You don't want to dwell on these things. But there are certain episodes that require this type of thing. If you want to see pain, violence, sex, you read your newspapers. There's plenty of it there. We have to bring it in where it belongs in the book in order to make the book interesting. You just can't write all about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain rhythm. I mean, in some ways, I think you're really at your best when you're writing violent scenes. There's a certain rhythm that you get in those
scenes. Yeah, you can get mad when you write. I punch holes in my paper. The yo's make holes. The periods go right into the platen of the machine. I break up typewriters so fast. And when I'm done with a story, that machine has to go in for repair. So you know what I'd do to it if I ever work with a word processor, tear it apart.
At the end of I, the Jury.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is like perhaps your most famous scene?
Well, this is the one that's so well remembered. This is the one I told you about. They said it was a sensual scene. I see, Mike, he's got a premise in his life. He is going to kill the person who killed his friend in the same way by shooting him in the gut. Now, at the end of the story there, when he's faced down with this woman that he loves, Charlotte, she knows what he wants to do. She has to get him away from this attitude. She starts to unrobe. She takes her clothes off piece by piece. And the description is of her getting down to the point where she's nude. And then she leans over while she's about to kiss him. She's really reaching for a gun behind his head. Now, if he's true to his premise, he'll stay alive. If he's not true to it, she's going to kill him. And, of course, what he does, he stays true. He shoots her right in the gut. Now, she's a psychiatrist. She couldn't understand that. And she says, "How could you?" And he says, "It was easy." And that's the way he was. That was the end of the story.
And that's your most famous line, I think, that it was easy.
Oh, yeah, it was easy.
Was it considered very unusual to have the private eye kill a woman at the end of a book?
Well, they didn't used to do it in those days. Women were sort of held up on a pedestal. I knocked this one off. I've already killed, I think, two women that made them villains in any of my stories, but they were effective.
Now, why is that something you wanted to topple in your story?
Women can be as deadly as men any time. Again, you know, just refer back to your newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun doing it to them. Of course, there are other times when women are treated with much more consideration than that.
Were there any limits, editorial limits, censorship limits to how much sex and violence you could use in the book and still be mass marketed? Were you always cognizant of what your limits were?
Well, the editors do funny things. And when I wrote One Lonely Night, Mike Hammer killed off 200 people with a machine gun, kept reloading and shooting. He was in a commie nest, a real deadly area, and he shot 200 people. And the editor says, "Oh, that's much too much, blood." So he knocked it down to 100 people.
That was supposed to be a big change.
That's your editorial concept.
In your novels, women lick their luscious lips seductively a lot.
Yeah.
I know I'm a woman and not a man, but I've really never seen a woman lick her lips.
Well, you never were watching.
Perhaps. As I say, you know,
that's a little game they play, you know.
Have you seen that a lot? Because, you know, I remember.
Sure, I've seen it many times. The French said they make a moo, M-O-U-E, you know,
I read that you were actually with the police on the bust of a narcotics ring.
Oh, I was on several of those big ones, yeah.
But that you took two bullets on one of them.
Well, I got one. Uh-huh. That was enough. Well, it was one shot, but it was a buckshot in the darn thing. Whenever you go out playing around, you're going to get hurt. So the best thing to do, don't go where trouble happens. Otherwise, you're going to be part of it, and then you can get clobbered. I'm not about looking for any of these things anymore. I'll use everything that's in my mind. I will use my imagination, I'll get into fiction and keep it that way. I don't want any more realism. That gets to be rough.
Well, this is a kind of weird question, but when you actually were shot, I don't know if this is too weird or not, but how did it compare with how you imagined it was when you had characters being shot in your book?
Well, it was a little bit screwy because I was standing behind a whole bunch of tomato paste. There was a slogan for this tomato paste. Who put those six big tomatoes in the itty-bitty cans? And the bullet went through the cans, got everybody splashed with tomato paste, and everybody thought they had all been shot as well.
Oh, gee.
So the shot just sprayed around, and it was...
How bizarre. Since you had tomato sauce all over, were you able to figure out right away where the actual wound was?
Yeah, you'll know right where that is,
right,
but
okay.
You're not considering that right away. Go, all you know is everybody got clobbered, and that was, you know, there you... It was kind of hard to get the tomato sauce off, though. It wasn't deadly, I'll tell you that.
So is the sensation something that you've recalled for writing?
No. You're better off if you use your imagination. You know, writing is something completely different. When you're writing fiction, it's easy. You can do things with fiction that nobody would ever believe in. Words are great. They're expressive. You can say things that you'd never experience and make them sound real. Hey, that's what being a writer is all about. I have as much fun writing as I do have reading.
You've said that the first part of a story that comes to you is the ending, because that's where you have
sure.
to get to, and that's in your novels the dramatic climax. It seems to me your titles come from the last page too.
Not always. No. When you're writing, see, it's like a joke. The only part of a joke you listen to is that punchline. So when you develop a story, that's your important part, is the big ending on there. Now, O. Henry did this in all of his stuff, and he was an old-time writer. I've just gone ahead and elaborated on his style a little bit in the structure of a story. Titles come out of the air. I don't know where they come from, but when I was doing The Killing Man, we couldn't get a title for that. And we were writing down all sorts of titles. We put them on the computers looking for any duplications and whatnot. And I was sitting there, all of a sudden I looked at it, I said, The Killing Man, that's it. And just popped into my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't try for a title until after the book is finished.
Something I recently learned about you is that you are, or were, I'm not sure which, a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, I've been a Jehovah's Witness since 1951.
You know, what surprised me about that was that I know you're not your character, but, I mean, Hammer is such the man alone that it seemed like hard for me to fathom that you were, you know, part of an organized religion.
Well, I'm not going to discuss it with you now, but next time one of Jehovah's Witnesses knocks on the door, call them in. They'll tell you all about it. But religion's a strange thing, you know. It's something you have personally in your lives, and you got to believe in it, and I believe in what I believe in.
Can I ask if the witnesses have ever objected to your books?
No. I don't think they read them, and I don't blame them. But... Now, what you're writing is just this is a job with me. I don't write for any express purpose like passing messages around. It's strictly a job. I try to keep them fairly contemporary and fairly clean. The first time I used a four-letter word in a book, I thought the publisher was going to go out of their minds, and this was a long time after it was coming out in other books. I don't try to use bad language, mainly because these are, again, are exclamation points within the story. And I try to keep things as... normal as possible. Anybody wants to read violence and sex, go to the newspaper. There's plenty of it there.
Something else I recently learned about you is that you collect blue willow pottery.
Yeah.
Which is a surprising hobby for a hard-boiled guy.
Well, it's not a one-time blue willow was just cheap kitchenware for all the farm ladies all over the country. It was made by different companies, but there was a classic thing about it. It was all excellently made. It was great chinaware, cheap, very cheap. But now it's up on the stage where, you know, it becomes antique and looks nice. And I lost a whole mess of it down in the hurricane.
Yeah.
And my wife collects pewterware, and she lost her pewterware. But we'll get it back. There's a lot of it out there, and the fun is going out collecting these things and doing it again. And I like it. It's useful. It's pretty looking. And it reminds me of my childhood, because we had it at home.
Well, speaking of your childhood... Your father was a bartender?
Yeah, he was a good Irish bartender in Brooklyn.
So did you hang out at that bar?
No, I would never hang out at a bar because I don't like the atmosphere of a bar. Nobody goes into a bar to get sober. And again, it's a trouble spot. bar scenes where you have restaurants, well, this is a different situation. But when you speak of a bar, you know what you're speaking of as like a neighborhood pub type of bar where everybody's in there and they finally, it's a place where they go and they don't want to go home. But I don't hang around in those places. Mm-hmm. I never did.
Mickey Spillane, thanks a lot for talking with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Mickey Spillane recorded in 1989. His 1970 Mike Hammer novel, Survival Zero, just came out in large print paperback. This is Fresh Air. Even tough guys get sentimental about the things they love. So give in to that impulse to support the kind of radio you love. Call with a pledge. Thank you. Mickey 1 is a crime film by Arthur Penn with a score by composer Eddie Sauter featuring saxophonist Stan Getz. The film came out in 1965, and the soundtrack was reissued last year. Sauter wrote glossy music for orchestra, and Getz improvised solos over the top. The two had teamed up earlier to record the album Focus. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the Mickey 1 soundtrack is one of the most successful records combining jazz and strings.
Arthur Penn's film Mickey 1 is a tall story about existential dread. Warren Beatty plays a downbeat nightclub comic with mob connections who runs away to become Joe Nobody just in case somebody's after him. The movie has a stark black and white look, peppered with a little loony symbolism. A blinding spotlight from a theater balcony stands in for an indifferent god. Mickey 1 is expressionistic and excessive, but it has a feverish quality all its own. One the music helps create. Composer Eddie Sauter and improviser Stan Getz. Their easygoing album Focus has been reissued many times. The soundtrack to Mickey 1 is now being reissued for the first time ever, with numerous alternate takes as a bonus. The score has many lovely episodes, but it plays more like Focus's grotesque twin, locked away in an attic for decades. Stan Getz, in effect, portrays the panic-stricken Mickey on saxophone, counterpoint to Warren Beatty playing him on screen. Getz made the most of the role. Playing Mickey took him back to his own scrappy younger days and on out to some new territory. You can imagine the puzzlement of record buyers who only knew him from The Girl from Ipanema. Eddie Sauter quotes a lot of musical styles in Mickey 1, an idea that wouldn't become a trend until the 1980s. Like many new ideas, it was an old idea. Charles Ives was quoting hymns and patriotic songs for specific effect 100 years ago. In the 1940s, Carl Stalling used bits of jukebox hits and popular classics in a similar way, writing music for Warner Brothers cartoons. Stalling's scores were a running series of musical gags that mirrored the action on screen. The Mickey 1 soundtrack is a more low-key workout on the same idea, with that added 60s touch of Stan Getz improvising in character. He treats Eddie Sauter's charts like they're the demons on Mickey's trail. In many ways, the movies and jazz grew up together. The film Close-Up came along around the same time as the extended jazz solo, and jazz showed movie makers and actors how to improvise within an intricate framework. In that light, Getz's improvising here, drawing on his own past, becomes a metaphor for Warren Beatty's method acting. The movie Mickey 1 has a much better reputation now than when it was first released, and now may be the time for its outlandish music. Eddie Sauter pokes fun at Stan Getz's meal ticket, Bossa Nova, but most every style gets exaggerated. The love themes are a little too lush, although Getz plays beautifully. The swinging big band bits sound like a parody of lurid jazz soundtracks for films like this one about showbiz sleaze and the underclass. Like the movie, the music pushes things to their limits. This is the kind of wacko project where someone says, decades from now, people will think this is brilliant. They were right.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed the soundtrack from Mickey 1, featuring Stan Getz, on the Verve label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, British best-selling mystery writer P.D. James explains why a grandmother who likes order and formality in real life creates mayhem and murder in her novels.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Trust, the private and powerful family behind The New York Times, by Susan E. Tift and Alex S. Jones, in hardcover wherever books are sold. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And from Perseus Books, publisher of The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, the best short works of Richard Feynman, with an introduction by Freeman Dyson.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week we're featuring a series of interviews with cultural heroes and one-of-a-kinds. P.D. James is a best-selling British mystery writer. Reviewers routinely place James in the same company as mystery masters like Agatha Christie, Arthur Conan Doyle, and Dorothy Sayers. James began writing mysteries in the early 1960s when she was holding down a full-time job in the British Civil Service and raising two daughters on her own after the untimely death of her young husband. The enormous popularity of her novels and of her detective hero, Adam Dalgliesh, eventually allowed her to devote herself full-time to writing. In 1991, Queen Elizabeth made P.D. James a baroness in recognition of her literary achievements. I spoke with P.D. James in 1985 when she was 67 years old. She told me why she writes in the detective genre.
Well, I suppose, Terry, I must really enjoy or be fascinated or perhaps even need the formal structure of the detective story. It seems to me that you have a framework which provides a kind of strength, and within that I can explore themes perhaps that I might not feel I wanted to explore outside the structure. I've given a lot of thought to this, and I think this must be the truth. I do love structure in a novel. I like formality, I like shape, I like organization in a model. And of course you do get that in the detective story.
Is there something liberating about working within a form?
Oh, I think it can be. You might imagine, you know, that the formula, because in one way there is a formula with the central mysterious death and the closed circle of suspects, and your detective, who must be either amateur or professional, comes in and solves the crime. The solution at the end of the book, which the reader should be able to arrive at himself by logical deduction, that is a formula in a sense. And sometimes people say, but this is formula writing. I don't think it need to be. What I think is interesting is that formula can be liberating of the creative imagination.
Do you think of yourself as belonging to a particular school within the genre of the detective novel?
I think I do. I think I'm very much in the Dorothy L. Sayers, Marjorie Allingham, to an extent, Niall Marsh tradition, which is the classical British detective story.
Which is what? What are the conventions of that form?
Very much, of course, as I've said, generally, with the death and the suspects and so on. But I think the form relies far more on characterization, on interest in motive, interest in people's relationships with each other, interest in the effect of murder on this group of people, the suspects, and to an extent on society itself, rather than on strong action, strong weaponry. I mean, we don't write the kind of mystery, the hard-boiled school, you know, when you have your sardonic, wisecracking private eye striding down the mean streets and kicking down doors and finding blondes and guns and bodies the other side of them.
But you're also not writing the kind of mystery where the whole focus of the novel is this intricate puzzle that the reader has to solve.
Not at all, no. This is, I think, the main way in which the modern mystery differs from the cozy mysteries of the 1930s. I mean, many of them were admirable, and I don't wish to knock them because they've given intense pleasure to many millions of people. But it seems to me that their ingenuity of plot, of method of death, and of the clues, these were dominant. And the characters on the whole were pretty pasteboard. I mean, they were just set up to be knocked down in the last chapter.
Would you put Agatha Christie in that category?
Oh, yes, I certainly would. I think she was an extraordinarily ingenious fabricator of puzzles, a kind of literary conjurer. But, of course, with many of the puzzles, they don't bear a lot of thinking about because, you know, you have your moment of surprise and think, my word, it's clever, it's brilliant. But if you go on to continue thinking about it, you realize that it couldn't possibly have worked in real life.
All writers who write about crime have to figure out how detailed, how explicit they want to make the death or the murder. Mm. And I'd like you to read a passage from your novel, The Taste of Death, in which the first person comes in who discovers the bodies that set the story in motion.
Yes, this is where poor Miss Wharton, this elderly church worker, has gone to the church to clean it and replace the flowers and finds the bodies in the vestry. And I suppose it is really rather horrific because murder is horrific. And I want my reader to feel Miss Wharton's terrible shock at what she finds. Brightly lit as on a stage, she saw the bodies still, more garish, more brightly lit than when they had first met her horrified eyes. One corpse had slipped from the low single bed to the right of the door and lay staring up at her, the mouth open, the head almost cleft from the body. She saw again the severed vessels sticking like corrugated pipes through the clotted blood. The second was propped, ungainly as a rag doll, against the far wall. His head had dropped forward, and over his chest a great mat of blood had spread like a bib. A brown and blue woolen cap was still on his head, but askew. His right eye was hidden, but the left leered at her with a dreadful knowingness. Thus mutilated, it seemed to her everything human had drained away from them with their blood. Life, identity, dignity. They no longer looked like men. And the blood was everywhere. It seemed to her that she herself was drowning in blood. Blood drummed in her ears. Blood gurgled like vomit in her throat. Blood splashed in bright globules against the retinas of her closed eyes. The images of death she was powerless to shut out swam before her in a swirl of blood, dissolved, reformed, and then dissolved again, but always in blood.
I think what I especially like about that is the impact that the discovery of the bodies has on the woman who finds them, how overwhelming the contact with death is for her. And a little later on, you write how she's afraid that she's going to vomit or that she's going to lose control of her bowels before she can even get to a bathroom. And I don't think of rotting bodies and of this contact with the stench of death as being a standard part of the British crime novel.
No. I think Ruth Rendell writes realistically about death, but it certainly isn't typical, really, of some of the best-known writers. In Agatha Christie, there's hardly any description of the corpse at all. In fact, I think in one book, I can't remember which one it was, we are told, you know, that it was killed by a blow to the head, and then later, I think, some other method of death, almost as if she really couldn't face the actual description of the body. She didn't want to write about it. She didn't want to think about it. And certainly Dorothy L. Sayers, whom I admire very much, is not very explicit about the actual corpses, is she? I think I'm trying to write a realistic novel. And murder is uniquely horrible. And I think that this shock of finding the bodies is important, really. The reader should feel it.
Well, I think that the passage that you just read not only sets the story in motion, but it sets another theme of your novel in motion, which is how awful it is to confront death.
Yes, to confront violent death, absolutely. And I think the novel deals with the effect of violent death, of murder, on everyone who comes in contact with it or who is involved with it. Dalgliesh thinks of it as a contaminating crime, and indeed it proves to be so that we see by the end of the book that nearly every life has been changed, including Miss Wharton's, of course.
Do you think that the form of the detective novel lends itself well to writing about larger themes, which is what you're doing within the form?
Well, I think it does for me. I don't think it does for everyone. The mystery, the word mystery, if we're using the American expression, which after all is a very good expression because it is about mystery, about a mysterious death, it embraces such an extraordinary variety of books, doesn't it? And I think many of them, even today, are written primarily as puzzles, not perhaps quite in the way they were in the 30s, but primarily as puzzles. And maybe the writers aren't particularly interested in any wider or deeper themes, but I think I am. I don't know when I begin the book that I consciously think this is going to be a book about guilt or this is going to be a book about the effect of murder on a particular society of people. But inevitably, before I'm halfway through, the theme does emerge, and it's usually a theme in which I'm intensely interested.
My guest is British mystery novelist P.D. James. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist P.D. James is my guest. The clues have to be fair in a detective novel, fair to both the detective and fair to the reader. What's out of bounds?
Oh, I think too great a coincidence. You see, what's interesting to me is that coincidence frequently happens in real life. We know in our own experience extraordinary coincidences happen. And they do, I think, very often in real life, investigation of murder. But somehow it isn't right in the mystery. We shouldn't rely on an extraordinary coincidence. And I think that the clues have got to arise naturally from the circumstances of the book and the people, the characters, and not sort of be inserted rather artificially as if they're sixpenny pieces and a plum pudding, you know, ready for the reader to pull out triumphantly and hold aloft and say, here's another clue. They must arise naturally, because they can be material clues, the obvious ones like handkerchiefs, buttons, cigarette ends. They can be the absence of something. Gardener working in the garden, yet there aren't any footprints in the beds. The dog that didn't bark in the night. They can be largely scientific, body fluids, blood, of course. And they can arise from character. Those are probably the most interesting. The way in which people behave at one particular time, behaving out of character, apparently.
You can't do anything like introduce a secret passageway at the end of the novel or have a twin brother come in who actually committed the crime, throwing everything off.
Oh, absolutely not. No. You could have a twin brother, of course, if the reader knew from the beginning that there was a twin brother. You can have a secret passageway if the reader knows from the beginning that this is a very old house and it's got a secret passageway. But both, I think, have been overdone, really, in the mystery, the twin brother and the passageway.
Do you have a rule of thumb? Does nearly everybody or does everybody in the novel have to be a suspect?
No, not necessarily. But I think one of the problems of writing the mystery is the number of characters you have to introduce. Because you obviously have a detective, and he's extremely important. In one way, he's the main character. You have your victim. Then if you're going to have a puzzle, it's intriguing, you probably need about three or four suspects. So already you've got four, five, six major characters. So in a way, from a technical point of view, you can't afford to have too many characters who are not playing a fairly important part in the book, you know, unless they're just extraneous walking on parts, as it were.
Should the reader be able to solve the crime before the detective does?
Oh, I think so, yes. One hopes that the reader won't, but very often in my books, the reader knows more than the detective does, because I will have a scene when two suspects perhaps are talking together and admitting things to each other, which they certainly aren't going to admit to Dalgliesh when he interviews them. So in a sense, the reader can be a little ahead of Dalgliesh.
Well, it's interesting, because the reason why the reader can do that is because you're writing in third person as opposed to a first person narrative told from the detective's perspective.
Yes, I think that's too restricting.
First person's too restricting?
Oh, I think so. Yes, because you're quite right. I mean, if you write it from the point of view of your detective, the reader can only see what he sees, hear what he hears, experience what he experiences. And I think the novel is more complex and more interesting if the reader can enter into the minds and thoughts of other characters. So I usually see the story through several eyes, shifting from one character to another. And this also has the advantage that sometimes you can deal with virtually the same event and see it through two entirely different eyes and see how in life one seemingly fairly simple event can present itself in two entirely different ways, depending on who is noticing, who is there, who is perceiving it.
In detective novels, the crime, the murder, usually introduces fear and disorder into the world. And then it's the detective's job to set things right again and to recreate a balance, to recreate order. I think that you violate that in a way, because at the end of the book, things aren't back to their state of order and balance again. People have been irrevocably changed.
This is true. I think, and this is one other way, really, in which the modern mystery can differ. You still have a solution. I think unless you had a solution at the end, it really wouldn't be a mystery. It wouldn't be written within the genre, to use a word I don't like, but it's the only word I think we can use. It might be a crime novel, but it wouldn't be a detective story. So you have to have the solution. But you nowadays seldom have a complete restoration of order, as you used to in the days of Agatha Christie and Mayhem Parva. There was this wonderful little village, you know, in which everybody, whether they were the parson or the doctor or the chemist or the district nurse or the squire, moved like figures on a chessboard, and this disruptive crime happened, and then, as you say, order was restored. And certainly in my novels, order isn't restored, or not necessarily so, because the innocent can suffer more than the guilty.
The detective, the American detective novelist Robert Parker, once told me that he thought one of the differences between the American detective novel and the English detective novel was that the English novel assumed that the regular state of being was order, the murder introduced disorder, and the detective could restore order again. Mm. Whereas the American hard-boiled detective novel assumed that chaos and irrationality was the normal state, and maybe a detective could create a little order for a temporary period, but then order, disorder and chaos would rule again. And I wonder if you find any truth in that.
Oh, I do. Yes, indeed I do. Certainly if we're looking, you know, again back to the novels of the 30s when Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler were writing, and if we look at the rather cosy English mysteries of the same period, the American one does give the impression that there is a society in a great state of flux, not a homogenous society, a violent society, and that the detective is, as it were, a lone crusader, and that his fight is as much against the police, whom he sees really almost as the agents of a corrupt society, as it is against the villains. And then if we look at the English mystery, there you have what appears to be a very ordered society, a very hierarchical society, a common view of law and order. And although the police are often buffoons and they're mere foils, you know, to the brilliance of the amateur detective, they're never violent and they're never corrupt. Now, of course, I think we're more realistic and we realise the police are unlikely to be notably any better than the society from which we recruit them. This is one of the other differences between the 1930s novel and the present one. But he's perfectly right. I would absolutely agree that those two mysteries almost represented interesting aspects of the two societies in which they were written. Because Raymond Chandler disliked the cosy British mystery very much, and I forget the name of the essay that he wrote about them. It's a very brilliant essay, but he did make the comment that the English may not be the best writers in the world, but they're the best dull writers. he was thinking, of course, of these very gentle mysteries.
Which do you prefer to read?
Well, I prefer to read the English, perhaps, not surprisingly, but I have a great admiration for the American writers. I think, on the whole, especially again if we're thinking of the 30s, they are far the better writers. I don't think there's any comparison. I mean, Raymond Chandler is a very fine novelist, so is Ross Macdonald, and infinitely finer novelist than Agatha Christie could ever be. Finer novelist than Niall Marsh.
Another difference, I think, between the English tradition and the American hard-boiled tradition is the constant wisecracking.
Yes.
That the American detective does.
Yes, yes. There's some notable one-liners out there, really.
And sex, too, because American detectives tend to have probably more active sex lives and get involved with glamorous but mysterious women of questionable motives.
Yes, but again, I'm thinking here of Dashiell Hammett, I suppose, and Raymond Chandler, and their attitude in the books to women. The women really seem to me to be either just performing some fairly lowly function. I mean, they're telephonists or they're stenographers or they're receiving the hero when he goes to visit the great man in his office. Or they are dangerous and evil. Very dangerous and evil. I remember many sort of professional, hard-working, successful young women in those books. And the hero may be indeed extremely attracted, but you feel that he knows he's being attracted to something which he shouldn't really touch because it is going to corrupt him and be evil.
Mystery writer P.D. James, recorded in 1985. This is Fresh Air. We've just heard from a great mystery writer. One thing that shouldn't be a mystery is why we're asking you for your support. So I'll explain. Fresh Air, like most nationally broadcast public radio programs, charges a fee to each station that carries it. The fees go into our production budget. Your station needs Fresh Air listeners to contribute enough money to pay the fee. Otherwise, the station can't afford to carry the show. So there's a direct correlation between your support of Fresh Air and your ability to keep listening to it. I hope you'll call with a pledge. Thank you. My guest is novelist P.D. James. You've always written under the name P.D. James. Your first name is Phyllis. Phyllis. Did you use the initials so that people wouldn't know you were a woman, or they wouldn't know what sex you were?
Well, I don't know, Terry. I don't think consciously I did, but, you know, goodness knows what goes on in the subconscious of a crime novelist. I can remember having no doubt at all that I wanted to write under my maiden name, not under my own family name and not my married name. And it was a choice of, therefore, having Phyllis James, Phyllis D. James, or P.D. James. And I thought, you know, that the last is short and it's slightly enigmatic, slightly mysterious. I just preferred it. And now, you know, when I've just done the signing of 300 books, I'm rather grateful that I chose P.D. James, I must say.
Less writer's cramp at those book signings.
Yes, less writer's cramp.
Do you think that if you'd used your name Phyllis and if people knew right from the start that you were a woman, that your sales would have been any different?
I don't think at all, because, you see, with this kind of writing in particular, women have quite a high reputation. It's not as if I were attempting to write a fast-action thriller, you know, to do with guns and midget submarines and war and... I mean, I'm not competent to write such a book. I never would wish to. But supposing a woman did want to write such a book, then I can see that possibly writing it under a feminine name might be a disadvantage. But I don't think writing a classical detective story would be.
You have very complicated plotting, which is just a part of the book. How do you organize the plot? Is that all done before you actually sit down and write chapter one?
Oh, yes, it is, Terry. There are different ways, aren't there, of writing crime fiction. I mean, we are told by Simenon that he, in fact, just chooses the names of his characters from the International Telephone Directory, locks himself in a room, puts them into a situation, and lets them get on with it. But I can't do that because of the kind of book I write, which is so closely plotted and so structured. I need to know exactly where I'm going, so that researching the book and plotting takes about as long as writing. And I do have notebooks, I have charts. It's all worked out very closely, really, before I begin. And yet, mysteriously, it does change during the telling.
Would it make you really angry if I told all of our listeners who did it in your book? I mean, how important would that be? I'm not going to do it. But how important would that be to you?
Well, Teddy, who knows? They might hear over the phone a terrible gurgling scream as I fastened my hands around your throat. I hope not. I hope not. Well, how important is it? Well, this is interesting, isn't it? I mean, obviously, I think people don't want to be told. Obviously, they're reading it partly for the puzzle. But what is interesting about the mystery is that the ones I really enjoy, I reread. I mean, the actual solution to the crime can't really be so dominant, can it? Because if it were, we would never reread. And we do reread our favourites. We know perfectly well who did it. But I don't think we want to know in advance of the first reading. That's for certain.
I'd better be careful then.
Oh, you had better be very careful.
I know a lot of people have commented that it seems almost ironic that here you are writing these novels, these mystery novels with rotting corpses and people whose lives are irrevocably changed by violence. And you are a very, controlled, probably pretty orderly woman, an older woman who seems to have great control over your life and
You're not probably the adventurous sort.
No. No, I don't think I am, Terry. You're quite right.
So does this seem like a great contradiction to you?
Well, maybe, you know, some way in which I exorcise what I think is quite a deep-rooted fear of violence on my part. I'm frightened of violence. I dislike violence. I do love good order, good social order, good psychological order. I don't like messy lives. I think this is perfectly true. Of course, none of us can be totally in control of our own life, and if we think we are, then all sorts of horrible little things jump out at us around the next corner, don't they? But I do like a fairly ordered life, fairly structured life, yes. This is true.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been very interesting, Terry. Thank you.
P.D. James recorded in 1985 when she was 67 years old.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Charles Dutton tells us how he learned to act while doing time in the pen. And we talk with comic and actor Damon Wayans. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.